In welcoming the next speaker, and notice that I do not say in introducing him because he truly does not need an introduction, I would just like to limit myself to two brief points. First of all, to remind you that our next speaker is a very distinguished professional in the field of legal affairs. He has a distinguished legal background. He's a graduate of the Harvard Law School. He practiced law with distinction in California, became a partner in a major law firm, served in the US government also as counselor to the president. And therefore, I wish to stress, given the nature of this conference, his legal background. But secondly, I want to take notice of the recent announcement of his forthcoming change of status. I believe this is his first major public appearance since that news was announced. And that, in a sense, gives him a right not to speak necessarily as a totally free private citizen, but as a person who does anticipate perhaps entering a new phase of his life. I want to assure you in this connection, Cap, that private life is not all that bad. There is life after death. But I want particularly to take advantage of this opportunity, which in a sense you have anticipated by your warm welcome, to acknowledge the debt that we all have to him, to you, Cap, for our safety, for enhancing our national security, for the truly dedicated, courageous, persisting commitment that you have displayed in the course of your unprecedented 7 years as Secretary of Defense to the cause of freedom. I think we are all stronger because of your service to the country. And this gives me special pleasure in welcoming you.
Very nice of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. That's a very warm and generous, over-generous introduction, and it exemplifies Biggs' dedication to something that I wish we could regain, and that is the bipartisan, nonpartisan approach to foreign policy. And I particularly liked the nonpartisan aspects that sounded so friendly and so favorable. So that was really very, very nice indeed, and I do appreciate it. And it is, of course, a great pleasure to be part of the very ambitious and important constitutional inquiry that you're undertaking in this bicentennial year of the of our national charter. And I'm especially pleased to have the opportunity to speak to an audience that undoubtedly will play really a very central role, I think, in shaping American law and society in the decades ahead, you and your successors. Many of the Constitution's framers, of course, were lawyers. And some of them were not much older than a good many members of the Federalist Society. They were called to Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 to amend the Articles of Confederation. But in true lawyerly fashion, they did a great deal more than that. They abandoned the Articles altogether. They crafted a whole new system of government that has stood the test of time now for 200 years. So you can see how far even a small group of lawyers can go, given the slightest encouragement. And Fortunately, the work they did was pro bono publico in the best sense of the word, and it was a very good thing for all of us that they did it. Well, the focus of this symposium, as I understand it, highlights the fact that even after 200 years, there still are certain questions of central importance to government about the balance among the three branches, about the limits of legislation, just to name a couple, that are really sewn into the very fabric of the Constitution. And I think that's inherent in any document or any product that emerges after a great deal of contentious and difficult discussion about very knotty issues. And they're bound to be compromises, and the compromises always leave some room for differing interpretations in the years ahead. And I thought I'd like to comment just briefly today, and I hope there'll be time for your questions, on a constitutional question that has really immense consequences for our nation's international interests, and that, of course, is the status of the War Powers Act. My argument, which I suppose will not surprise a great many people here, is very simple, and that is that the War Powers Act is just unconstitutional. Every president who has been subjected to the law has regarded it as unconstitutional, and I really don't see how any president could support it. and still remain faithful to his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. I do understand that, obviously, a law that has been passed and been signed, as unfortunately this was, or passed over a veto, either way, that kind of act is part of the law of the land until it's held unconstitutional. But that does not preclude presidents, and they certainly have taken advantage of that, to argue that it is indeed unconstitutional. And I think there are basically three reasons why this act should be rejected. It does infringe on the president's authority as commander-in-chief, as chief executive, conducting the conduct of our nation's foreign and defense policies are clearly in his hands, and this infringes on that, I think. And then it gives Congress a legislative veto over the actions of the executive, which has been fairly recently in Chavez held to be unconstitutional. And thirdly, the War Powers Act really fails the task of or the test of political prudence, because even as it strips power from the president, it enlarges the powers of a branch of government that is really not well equipped to manage international affairs. There's another small problem about the War Powers Act from the point of view of the military, and that is that in the absence of a favorable vote, after certain declarations and reports are made, the president is required to force American forces to disengage from what may be very close contact with the enemy under circumstances that could quite conceivably not be very safe for our troops. But with that degree of rigidity is one of the things that I think we have to worry about very much, totally aside even from constitutional arguments. Of course, the act was inspired by our ill-fated involvement in Vietnam. Congress sought to limit executive authority in the belief that a weakened president and a more assertive legislature would somehow produce a more judicious foreign policy. But congressional advocates, I think, based their whole case for the act on historically dubious assumptions and really a flawed understanding of the Constitution. They assumed that the war powers, the authority to deploy America's armed forces to defend its interests, belonged by right to the legislative branch. And they said frequently, and in the debate at that time it was said, that it belonged to the legislative branch despite the fact that presidents have assumed it even from the time of Washington, which is a pretty good argument as to why it belongs to the president. The War Powers Act, under this theory of Congress at that time, sort of takes powers usurped by the president and restores them to the legislative branch. And that's a comfortable assumption for Congress, but it doesn't happen to be very accurate. Senator Javits summed it up pretty well. He said, and he was one of the driving forces behind the act, he said the president has no authority to employ the nation's armed forces without explicit congressional permission. Javits said the president is just commander-in-chief, period. Well, I do have serious problems with this. Congress set out, I think, in following that theory, on a revolutionary redesign of the constitutional balance of powers with very little awareness that the legislation that it would pass might seriously jeopardize the nation's ability to defend our interests abroad. And I think it's especially appropriate in this year of our bicentennial to recall the framers' reasons for placing primary responsibility for international affairs on the president. Why did they do it in the first place? It's clear they had a far different view of presidential power than the legislators who enacted the War Powers Act. Hamilton argued in The Federalist that the prime characteristic of the presidency is energy. And he meant by that the capacity for prompt and unambiguous actions. In the conduct of foreign affairs, I suppose one of the greatest errors that can be made is indecision, delay, frequent shifts in the nation's policies, because these quickly dispirit our allies. They send a signal of weakness that encourages our foes and invites aggression. And Hamilton understood very well that the president's capacity to act with energy followed from the power of a unitary executive, for which he also argued. Unitary executives, he could speak with a single authoritative voice, in sharp contrast to the Congress, where debate and due deliberation rather than decisive action are that branch's special virtues. And then we have to remember the principal problems with the Articles of Confederation was that there was no place where this kind of decisive, energetic action could take place. Now, Jefferson held frequently quite different views. He was described by some as the arch rival of the Federalist and the Federalist school. And he was well known for his great worries about executive power. But he assumed, without any question at all, the president's primacy in international affairs. He said the transaction of business with foreign nations is executive altogether. He wrote that to Washington in 1790. And executive powers, he said, belong to the head of that department, the executive department, except such portions of it as may be specifically submitted to the Senate, exceptions that Jefferson concluded should be construed very strictly. These were obviously the confirmation, ratification powers, things of that kind. This was, I think, a good position for him to take, because when he did become president a decade later, he didn't hesitate to use his full executive powers, whether to authorize such things as the Louisiana Purchase or to dispatch the U.S. Navy to defend against the Barbary pirates that were preying on commercial vessels in the Mediterranean. No declaration of war there. He did not have to alter his views after he became president, even though he had a very limited view, as we all know, of the actual powers of the president and a very specific idea that the president's power should be very tightly construed, very narrowly held, because of his overriding fear of a centralized, all-powerful executive. So it isn't the founders of the intent necessarily that we should seek only that, but the wisdom of the congressional design that they created. The architects of the Constitution placed the power to conduct international affairs in the hands of the president, really for the best of all practical reasons. Concentrating responsibility for international conduct in the Congress would have been a recipe for disaster, and it was frankly one of the reasons why the Articles of Confederation failed and why the Constitutional Convention was called in the first place, and why those wise lawyers at the time realized that they couldn't really amend the Articles, that they had to have a whole new Constitution. Well, last month, the Senate's debate on the administration's Persian Gulf policy is I think, a very clear case in point. Zbig was nice enough to mention that I'm approaching the time when I can speak more freely, but I have been impolitic enough and unwise enough to speak more freely too many times too early. What I'm about to say may seem to be impolitic, but I think it's important for us to realize just what that debate actually was. It was, first of all, it was loud and it was long. And some of the senators supporting the president's action, and some called for the invocation of the War Powers Act, and others were seeking a way to exert control over the president's actions in the Gulf without resorting to the War Powers Act. In the end, the Senate produced a resolution that was really almost Delphic in its character, not in its wisdom, but in its uncertainty. The Senate did not, but later did pass, a resolution that might or might not support the president's course of action in the Gulf. They had two votes first. The resolution was defeated, 47 to 51. Then within hours, the Senate spoke again and passed the resolution, 54 to 44. The resolution now, of course, still has to pass the House and be signed by the president. And though I rarely predict presidential actions, I feel reasonably sure in telling you that should it pass in this form, the president would, I think, not view it very favorably. But that resolution requires the president to submit a report on our Persian Gulf policy within 30 days after enactment, and then puts the Senate on schedule on the so-called expedited procedure or fast track, so that there must be another vote 30 days beyond that. And what's that vote on? It's on a resolution that still has to be drafted. Nobody knows what it would contain, because it's just vote on a resolution. Without knowledge of whether the resolutions would call for a declaration of war, the removal of all forces from the Gulf, or any permutation or combination of any existing policy that you might think of, the Senate granted its approval. So what they did was not pass, then pass, a resolution that called for a resolution of some kind to be adopted within 60 days. Now, if that sounds confusing, I think that's only because it is. And even the Senate found itself in some quandary. Senator Bumpers, who has otherwise, well, I won't say it, has, he declared that the resolution that finally won approval was carefully designed to do nothing. I'm delighted to find myself in agreement with the senator on this one matter. Senator Weicker, who was disappointed in the weakness of the resolution, said, nevertheless, it's better to do something than nothing. So we must do something. And so they went ahead and did it. Senator Pryor seemed to me to sum it up as best of anything. In the final analysis, he said, I don't know what we're doing. Well, now this is not really the kind of signal that of American resolve that we should send to the Ayatollah or to the Soviet Union or to our friends or our allies. We understand that Congress is the home of very diverse and divergent views from the nation's many states and districts, and that's exactly what it's supposed to be. And that is a good way to forge a compromise. But the Senate's inconclusive debate on our Persian Gulf policy illustrates, I think, that congressional deliberation often fails to yield any clear course of action, and indecision in international affairs can really be fatal. So a broader role in the shaping of international affairs is what our Congress claims to deserve, but it is very hard to see thus far how it can be carried out or that desire can be achieved. What effect would invoking the War Powers Act have on our current policy in the Gulf? There's a lot of obvious indecision on the Hill. The key feature of the War Powers Act, which is the maximum 90-day time limit for the deployment of our forces without express congressional approval, this is the so-called negative approval resolution, would keep the administration and our allies all around the world in suspense as that 90-day deadline approached. This is not the resolution I was just talking about. This is the War Powers Act itself. And it would raise serious questions about our will to protect vital interests in the Gulf. As you got nearer the 90 days, Congress might adjourn, might get tied up with a budget fight, might have a filibuster, all kinds of things. The 90th day could go by, the resolution of specific approval would not be passed, and a president would have to pull the forces out immediately. And it's very hard to disengage, as I mentioned a moment ago. If you are directly engaged in combat, or if the ships are pursuing a policy at sea, that if they disengage quickly, without any kind of military situation justifying that, can put all aboard and or all involved in very great danger. So during that 90-day period, the Congress would presumably be debating the Gulf policy. There's no guarantee, as I say, that the deliberations would result in any decision, and it's very likely that Congress might find it impossible to agree on any course, and therefore, because it would relieve anyone from the necessity of being recorded on a roll call, would do nothing at all, in which case the forces would have to come out. And under the terms of the War Powers Act, congressional inaction would, in effect, constitute a legislative veto, which the president himself would not be allowed to act upon. And that's a completely unconstitutional feature of the act under comparatively recent decisions of the court. The imposition of this kind of arbitrary limit, I think, would really make for a nightmare. And I don't think that I would be far wrong in saying that I would suspect that everyone who had responsibility as big as had and carried out so very well, and others, that there's no way really in which you could fulfill your responsibilities to the president, or the president could fulfill his responsibilities to the country, with that kind of an arbitrary set of actions forced upon us. It really invites our adversaries to turn the War Powers Resolution into a straitjacket on American policy. The maximum 90-day limit, the 30-day limit, and the Senate resolution, all of these things would encourage our enemies to take aggressive actions aimed at pressuring the Congress to order a reversal of our policy. And it should be no surprise that the enemies of democracy have, of course, become very skilled in the art of using to their own advantage the very rules that make democracies work. We've seen that in some of our court actions immediately after World War II. We've seen it in the attempts of the Soviets with the withering propaganda. They turned loose on NATO, trying to block deployment of the ground-launched cruise missiles on the Pershings. In all of these ways in which they can utilize free public opinions in the West, and of course we can't there because there is no public opinion in the Soviet Union. And a legislature that got pulled in several different directions by many voices in it can't really insulate itself from the powerful passions that really erupt during times of international tension. The transitory nature of public opinion has a profound impact on the ability of Congress that to act in a cool and energetic way to implement strategy that may require changes, decisions, difficult actions, almost hour to hour, let alone day to day. In the Persian Gulf, our interests are very long-standing. We've been there since 1949. A precipitous withdrawal driven by a momentary spasm of public sentiment would have implications for America's interest in the region and our role in the world that are simply incalculable. I had the privilege of visiting our forces in the Gulf about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and in the course of doing that, talked with many of the littoral states whose interests are directly concerned with the Gulf, perhaps almost more directly, obviously, than ours. There was one common thread that ran through all of this, the fear that America would not stay, the fear that America was not resolute enough, the fear that if they joined and helped us, as we were urging them to do, and as they have done very well in many individual situations, the fear that America would, at any possible kind of event or pretext or loss, and there are risks in the Gulf, that we would simply walk away, leaving them in a far more serious situation with Iran, and causing them a great deal of question, worried as they are about Iran's actions and their own future, leaving them with a great deal of question as to whether the United States, frankly, was a reliable ally. And that is, I think, a very widely felt opinion, not only in the Gulf states, but in other parts of the world. And so this kind of activity by the Senate, should it be passed by the House, I'm sure it would be vetoed by the President, but if it should become law, that and the War Powers Act, with it, with its inherent uncertainty that by its very terms it creates, necessarily causes a great deal of anxiety, a great deal of uncertainty. And when we have very strong voices demanding here that why don't our allies do more to help us, we don't have far to hunt for the reason sometimes. They are very uncertain as to whether helping us is a safe course for them. Now, we are getting, fortunately, a very great deal of help from our friends in the Gulf. Part of the tremendous practical wisdom of the founders of our Constitution was their understanding that in Adams' famed formulation that ours is a government of laws and not men, we can't legislate for every circumstance. And nowhere is this more true than in the form of international affairs. You simply can't predict all of the things that might happen. Lawyers try to do that frequently. In contracts and leases and wills, we always try to figure all of the conceivable events that might happen and plan for them and write down what will happen in the event that should take place. And we can't do it because nobody can foresee all of the possible activities. But this is, I think, perhaps nowhere more true than international affairs, where events can change so rapidly with so little or no warning, and where instant adjustments in policy are vital, and where swift action of a single leader can literally be the difference between victory and defeat. So the Constitution wisely grants the very broad authority to the President to formulate these foreign and defense policies. His power is not unbounded. He is responsible to the people and to their representatives in Congress. He has certainly, this president, I think, done everything to inform and confer with the congressional leaders on our policies in the Gulf. Few people seem to remember it, but we started conferring with the Congress way back in March when this issue first arose. And we may have, and we do have, as you've seen, very differing interpretations from many as to the War Powers Act. that call on the President to report his actions to the Congress, but we have fulfilled all of those and more. We have actually briefed members of the Congress more than 100 times just since the attack on the Stark in May, and several times before that. The War Powers Act, though, really unsettles the balance of powers that the framers built into the Constitution. It weakens the President's ability to conduct international affairs. It enlarges the body, the influence of a body that basically is not capable of taking kinds of decisive action, but by its very nature. It's not a criticism of the Congress. It's just a comment on its inherent structure and formation. And so from this purely practical standpoint, the War Powers Act is unwise, whereas from the perhaps you might call technical point of view, I think it is clearly unconstitutional. And no president really can submit to the time limits in the War Powers Act that constrict his freedom, interfere with his constitutional duty, and may very well require him to take actions that would put our forces in grave physical danger. So invoking this act would be, I think, a very serious, and would do very serious damage to our influence and our interests now and in the future. And I'm afraid that in its attempt to prevent ill-considered presidential action, the War Powers Act seriously infringes on the President's ability really to act at all. And in that very fundamental respect, we think that it's a cure that's far worse than the disease. Thank you very much. You've listened very attentively, and I do appreciate it. I'll try to take a few.
You have no time?
Two or three.
The secretary has indicated that he has time for two or three questions. So if you make them brief, we'll get three in. Who would like to start the discussion? Where? All right, please. Please go to the microphone.
Mr. Secretary, I, among others, respect the great job that you've done in your 7 years. And I think I first met you at the Palm Beach Roundtable in Palm Beach,
yes,
when you gave a speech there in 81.
Yes.
And I asked you a question from the audience and then talked afterwards regarding the Monroe Doctrine and shouldn't we reaffirm it? And I think your answer at the time was the public opinion might not be ready yet. I was wondering what your assessment is now as you leave.
This was a good, our opinion on what, I just missed the...
Reaffirming the Monroe Doctrine.
Oh, the Monroe Doctrine, oh yeah. Well, I have never had any basis really for saying that we should change the Monroe Doctrine, and I think some of the things that are happening now would reinforce its basic wisdom.
Secretary, I think I'm not, is this on? I think I'm not unique in admiring you as one of the most capable of the President's assistants.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm very sad to see you leave. I would like you to say one thing today that would make me a little happier. That is to say the press variance that you're leaving because of a very unfortunate personal family problem, which your wife apparently has made a statement against. And yet we are having an international treaty of the most enormous significance for exactly your area of responsibility over 7 years. Now, I wonder why it is that the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Weinberger, is leaving exactly at a moment when it seems like his enemies have prevailed in the Department of State and are going to foist upon us a treaty that will injure our interests.
No, that if that were the case and enemies were about to prevail, that would be the most exhilarating time to stay. No, at my basic, first of all, with respect to the INF Treaty, I should be quite clear. I think the INF Treaty is basically something that is good for the United States. What I worry about, what a lot of people worry about, are various things that may follow. But the treaty itself, which takes out 4 or 5 Soviet warheads for every one of the U.S., assuming it's verifiable, and nobody has seen the verification provisions written down or not, but if it is verifiable, and only if it's verifiable, then I think that treaty itself would be basically very much in our national interest. And it is indeed something that the president suggested in October of 1981, that if the Soviets would take out all of their SS-20s and 4s and 5s, 12s, 23s, all of those, we wouldn't put in the ground launch cruise missile or the Pershing. And that would be a proper arrangement, a proper result. The Soviets laughed at that. And perhaps the greatest tribute, I think, to the president's leadership and vision in regaining strength, military strength of the United States, is the fact that a proposal which the Soviets totally and scornfully rejected in 1981, they have now fully agreed to in principle, even though, as I say, it's not yet written down. They had no incentive to do it before. Now they have the incentive of a strong, rearmed America. And so I think that is very much in our interest. On the personal side, my wife has been carcinoma. That is, we believe, completely over, but she has been extraordinarily uncomfortable because of broken vertebrae, broken bones in her back. She, unlike all the rest of us, is a very private person and finds all this discussion extremely distasteful, but I simply feel and have felt for some time that it was proper for me to look at some other personal obligations after 7 years of extraordinarily rewarding and fascinating work under a great leader. But I think the treaty itself that's coming up now is a treaty that is in our interest, and I don't have any trouble with it. There are a lot of other things that are being proposed that should follow within hours or whatever, and no one has seen the verification provisions. And any treaty that is not thoroughly verifiable in view of the Soviets' long and lamentable record of cheating wouldn't be in our interest, and the president is very much aware of that. But we have been told by the Soviets they will agree to verification provisions that we have said we want. I have to say, I don't think that any verification provision, no matter how intrusive, is a total guarantee, but it's certainly far better than anything we've even talked about in the past. And if all that materializes, then I think that treaty's in our interest, and I can go with a clear conscience. Right, one more, yeah.
Last question.
Yeah. Let me just say, first of all, Secretary Weinberger, that I'm proud to have to be able to say that I served in your Defense Department on a destroyer in the Persian Gulf in 1985. But actually, what I have to ask you about is really on another topic. I just want to say I appreciate very much your vigorous defense of the President's Commander-in-Chief power, and may I say that it's a rather marked contrast to the panel that we just had that supposedly was dealing with that vis-a-vis the Congress's war and spending powers. And inasmuch as I think that you'd find large agreement here with your assertion that the War Powers Act might be an unconstitutional veto over the president's commander-in-chief powers, does it strike you as a little bit odd that if they cannot do that directly through their war powers, that they can do that indirectly through their power to rescind funding? And I suppose that really relates more to the situation than just occurred with the Iran-Contra affair, and do you have any comment on that?
Well, I have, you shouldn't really get me started on congressional actions on our defense funding, because that takes about 4 hours, and I don't think you have the patience, and sadly, I don't have the time. But historically, traditionally, all the way back to 1219, the House of Commons has had, and the legislative branch has had, the power of the purse. We cannot spend a nickel that Congress does not appropriate, and we shouldn't be able to, recognize that. It is quite true, as you say, that by cutting off all funding, and cutting off all authorization for funding or for spending anything, the Congress does have, in the final analysis, the ability to constrain very severely necessary governmental action. And that's one of the reasons that some people get to be warm admirers of the parliamentary system. When you finally win an election under a parliamentary system, you have a majority and are able to carry out the policies that the people elected you to do. I mentioned this once to Mrs. Thatcher, and she said, oh, but you haven't seen some of my backbenchers. That is a possible limitation there. But it is quite true that with the power of the purse, the Congress does have ultimately the power to stop everything and forbid any expenditure of any money in the Gulf for any purpose if they wanted to do that. Now, in order to be constitutional, the president has the right to veto that, and it has to have the right to veto that. And then if the Congress overrides him, then our constitutional provisions allow us no option. But the way the Congress has done it with the War Powers Act is to forbid that by inaction and not let the president act on it and not have to veto or not have any right to veto or not have any chance of the override vote coming in. So we recognize that that is an inherent limitation on executive power and one that can be very disruptive if it's executed or carried out irresponsibly. But the War Powers Act violates all of those provisions, it seems to me. But the lack of adequate funding is something that can undermine all of the things we've tried to do and all of the things that I think we have accomplished. And so we worry very much about the preoccupation with defense cutting. The reason that it is so subject to that is that it is the least popular of all the expenditures, as I'm afraid know better than anyone, and it is therefore the prime candidate, not on a priority basis, but on a political basis. You get the least possible political cost and blame by cutting defense. And the deficit has not come from defense. The deficit has come because even though defense was cut, domestic expenditures have been added to so much more on the other side. We can demonstrate mathematically that it's very dangerous to cut the defense budget because it always means the deficit goes up. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Give me 20 seconds.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, you'll see behind me the profile of one of the founding fathers of this republic. Well, one of the founding father of the Federalist Society is David McIntosh, and he's here to make a presentation to the Secretary.
Thank you. One of several. It's a tradition of the Federalist Society to present its distinguished guests with a copy of the Federalist Papers. As Secretary Weinberger knows, they're a source of enduring truth and wisdom about the American Constitution and the protection of liberty that it guarantees. It is especially appropriate that we present the Federalist Papers to you, Secretary Weinberger, because you, more than any individual in President Reagan's administration, have worked ceaselessly to establish an enduring national defense that will be a bulwark for the defense of freedom at home and abroad for this generation and the next. It's a great honor to present you with these.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.